It's masks off and away we go for another flat chat. And as usual at this time of year, this month's issue of GP Racing looks forward to the British Grand Prix at Silverstone, which is expected this year to welcome 140,000 fans. And meanwhile, the Australian Grand Prix, which was due to happen at the beginning of November, was it the end of November? I forget. Has been cancelled owing to pandemic-related logistical issues. So, two steps forward and two steps back, if I may take the liberty of paraphrasing a 1990 hit by Paula Abdul. Probably not for the first time in this podcast. Here to discuss all this and more is one person who is going to the British Grand Prix and one person who isn't. So, welcome the person who is, Mark Gallagher.
Yeah, great to be here. I'm looking forward to going to a Grand Prix next week. It's very exciting.
A grand épreuve, F1 by any other name, as yeah. I believe Peter Winsor once said. And welcome Ben Anderson, not going to the British Grand Prix.
No, waiting for FIA Formula One protocols around the paddock and access to move a little bit further in the direction of normal, shall we say.
As in us actually being allowed to go in and allowed to speak to anyone rather than...
In a sheep pen.
Yeah, the monkey cage, as I believe some people call it.
Really? That sounds a little bit more wild than I was expecting.
Well, it's the people who are in it that you have to worry about, isn't it? And welcome someone who is going to at least to the Saturday of the British Grand Prix. That's me. I'll be doing the GP Racing Fan Village at Whittlebury fan quiz on Friday night, and just had a request yesterday to stay on to Saturday to do the Autosport podcast. So all I need to do now is actually get into the track on Saturday and watch sprint qualifying. So we're working on that. So
we have a GP Racing
Fan Village.
A fan village.
So okay. I mean, we've all seen Heidi High, haven't we? Well, maybe the younger members of the audience haven't.
No, Ben Anderson is shaking his head. He's never watched Heidi High.
Okay, well,
I've heard of it at least.
Yeah. GP Racing and in its previous incarnations, F1 Racing, has had a fan village at Whittlebury Hall, or Whittlebury Park, I think, is the general campus, which is right next door to Silverstone. And you can camp there and basically walk in. And you come in kind of at the back of the Beckett's Maggots complex. Lovely little walk in.
I might walk over and have a look then.
Indeed you may.
You can heckle Stuart Codling as he does his quiz.
That'd be good.
Usually TV's David Croft. I write it and TV's David Croft does it, but because of various bubble-related malarkey, he can't. He's unable to attend. So this is sounding terribly Alan Partridge, isn't it? I'm afraid Sue Lawley has cancelled. but anyway, yeah, so the British Grand Prix is part of the government's events research programme, which enables it, and I have to get my nomenclature right, to disapply certain elements of the COVID legislation, which is being repealed and torn up the next day anyway. So when we talked exclusively to Silverstone boss Stuart Pringle about basically the roller coaster of trying to organise this year's event, he was saying, you know, we were in a situation where we were going to be having it in front of empty grandstands, and then 9 hours after the flag flew, all that legislation gets torn up anyway.
And everyone can come in.
And everyone could come in and, you know, wave at the empty track. So, yeah, I mean, obviously opinions are divided about the wisdom of having that many people at a sporting event. And obviously Stuart Pringle flags up that although there's going to be a lot of people there, it's Silverstone's got a 5 mile perimeter with many gates. I think it's 60,000-70,000 grandstand seats all in the open air and lashed by wind depending on which county you're in. Both counties suffer equal amounts of wind. Two very different ways of treating the pandemic emerging, isn't it? You either have the Australian model of trying to shut it out, a little bit like Vincent Price in The Mask of the Red Death. Spoilers, it gets in anyway. This whole business of trying to live alongside it.
Listeners will no doubt remember I spent 6 months in Australia and got back in May, and Australia has been COVID-free. There's been no COVID in the community to speak of. Any outbreaks that you've heard about have come from the quarantine hotels where travellers into the country have had to stay for 2 weeks. And the reason it's come out of those hotels is that in some cases, security staff or other staff in the hotels came into contact with people. And so there's been a couple of kind of leaks of COVID into the community. But the test and trace system in Australia is formidable. I mean, they literally will come on the news and say, if you're on the number 59 bus in Sydney at 10 past three last Thursday, you need to go and get tested. It's extraordinary how effective and efficient it is and the way people use it. So the good news is that Australia, when I was there for 6 months, there's just no COVID in the community. In South Australia, we, capital is Adelaide there, of course, no mask wearing at all, just complete freedom. The only thing you noticed was you had to check into places. The downside, as you said, Stuart, is that for the Australian Grand Prix organisers, Australian Grand Prix Corporation, have come up against the problem now that because the country has had no COVID to speak of and has a very low vaccine uptake, very, very low vaccination uptake. I think this week it's up to about 15%. So 85% of the country's just not vaccinated.
They call it the stroll out, don't they?
Yeah, that's right.
Rather than the rollout.
The great stroll out. So the problem now is that they actually just have this kind of island, literally, where they can't afford to let anyone come in. And in fact, they've reduced the number of people allowed into Australia by 50%, down from 6,000 to 3,000. I think that's a month, or maybe it's a week. I assume it's three. No, it must be 3,000 a month. So it's an incredibly low amount of people allowed into the country. And I can tell you from my family, who my kids and my wife are still over there, there's a growing recognition that they have gone from kind of world leading in terms of not letting COVID in to now feeling completely out of sync with the rest of the world. They should have been vaccinated even though they didn't have COVID in the community, but the government has kind of held back on that. And there's been something of a bunker mentality. Anyway, they're paying the price for it in a pretty severe way. And it's a shame that Phillip Island for the MotoGP and Melbourne for the Formula One event have now had to cancel for a second year in a row. And it wouldn't have been necessary had they, frankly, copycatted Europe and the UK in terms of vaccination, a sense of urgency around the vaccination. The thing that really concerns me now is that because of the slow pace of vaccinations, they really now in Australia need to get moving over the course of our autumn, their spring, in order to ensure that the Grand Prix can come back there in March or April of next year, because it'll be there before they know it. And if they get any aspect of this wrong and there are more outbreaks, public opinion in Australia is absolutely against, you know, allowing travellers into the country, and the government has support from people on that. So there's a really it's highly problematic. And interestingly, this week I did a couple of interviews for Australian media after the cancellation of the Grand Prix, and it was really interesting to hear the line of questioning that was coming from the Australian media. First of all, there's a big concern that Formula One might somehow penalise Melbourne for having a second year cancellation, and I had to assure them that I really didn't think that would be the case. But the other interesting thing is that there is a story going around in Australia that Melbourne will never return to its being the opening round of the World Championship. And the media were telling me that they believe that Melbourne's going to move to being kind of race three or race four in the schedule, that someone else is steamed in and is going to pay a lot of money to have the opening race of the season. So I don't have any other information to back that up, but that's certainly the story.
Bahrain, yeah.
Yeah, Bahrain did get mentioned. So I think maybe Bahrain and Abu Dhabi are keen to top and tail the World Championship. So anyway, it's a shame. And then obviously, as you say, Stuart, with the British Grand Prix, we've got the exact opposite. I mean, it was quite amazing, really, for me to go on Australian media this week and talk about Australia cancelling the Grand Prix and then being able to say to everyone, I'm going to Silverstone next week with 140,000 other people. And this is a country where we've had nothing but COVID in the community for the last 18 months. And it's been horrific in terms of its impact on the country. But it just goes to show that's the difference with having an effective and urgent vaccine rollout.
Although there's no guarantee that even if you're double jabbed, you won't get it. So, you know, increasing anecdotal evidence, you know, Andrew Marr had it. One of the guys on my virtual bike racing team has had it despite being double jabbed. So, yeah, it's not a... We're not invulnerable when we've had the vaccine, but we can only hope to mitigate it, haven't we? I think the lessons of the past 18 months are is that this it's not going to flush down, is it?
No, we're in that, like Mark says, the opposite end of the spectrum. It's here and it's got its claws into the country. So the best bet is the vaccination program and the hope that even if it still spreads, and it's likely to, isn't it? You know, the day after the British Grand Prix, there's going to be the great unlocking, as it's been termed, and there's already an expectation that cases will skyrocket and that will lead to extra hospitalizations and deaths, but we don't know how many, and the government unfortunately won't tell us how many expects either, really. So this is all one great big experiment, and Silverstone is part of that. I mean, you mentioned the events research program. It's a gamble, isn't it, to see what happens when you do let all these people come together and mix again as they did before, but with the added benefit of testing to get in, so you likely or you shouldn't have it when you go in, and obviously vaccinations to protect people if they do contract the virus, and hopefully they won't get sick and hopefully nobody will die. But I don't know. I mean, I feel like for the British Grand Prix, obviously it's a brilliant thing to be able to do this, and we've seen some events already in the calendar, particularly in Austria recently, with fans back and the atmosphere that the Orange Army created for Max Verstappen's recent victory, and also the atmosphere in the football stadiums as the Euros have happened, and you know, obviously England winning their semi-final against Denmark in front of a packed stadium. I mean, that kind of atmosphere and joy and a sense of shared participation in events has been missed greatly. So, provided everybody is sensible and, you know, does their own risk assessment before they go, then have at them, I guess. Also, a lot of people have rolled their tickets over, haven't they? You know, these are people that wanted to go to the British Grand Prix last year. They've paid their money. The fact that Silverstone is expecting a full crowd suggests that people, hopefully knowing everything that's going on in the context, are prepared to take the risk and go for it. So, and obviously lots of things are being done to mitigate the risk at the same time. So let's cross our fingers and hope that it's a fantastic event, great spectacle, and that everybody's safe and healthy afterwards.
I'm hosting 400 people for the 3 days of the British Grand Prix, but I'm not going to open proceedings by saying to them we're all part of a great experiment.
No, I respect that. I wouldn't have thought that should be your opener.
On percentage terms, 28 of you are going to leave here with COVID, and we expect 4 of you not to be around in a few weeks' time. So we may as well enjoy the weekend for all that we can get out of it. It's going to be great.
Some people may think that's slightly too flippant.
I think so. Anyway. But it is interesting what Silverstone are doing. And just, I mean, it's just a small point that listeners might be interested to know when they're kind of debating the wisdom of having a packed house at the British Grand Prix. Because of the bubble system, all the people who you would know as being paddock regulars are not allowed to go anywhere else inside the circuit. And you might say, well, you know, that there isn't much implication about that. Well, one of the implications is that for Silverstone, It's one of the few Formula One venues around the world where you have hospitality other than the Formula One paddock club. And actually, Silverstone has a vast number of hospitality units all around the track, all operated by independent contractors and owners. And usually, they are able to get people like David Coulthard or Martin Brundle or Karen Chandock to come across and do a 20 minutes on stage, or David Crofts to come and do something, or Lee McKenzie to come and do something. And that's not possible. So there's been a huge problem this year where all the hospitality units literally can't get anyone who's actively involved in the Formula One weekend from a paddock perspective. And it's been quite problematic because some of those companies have been selling tickets on the basis that they're going to have a celebrity they're going to have a celebrity appearance by, you know, a Formula One driver. Well, the fact of the matter is you just can't do it. And so it's led to, I think, quite a few calls to the BRDC saying, who have you got in the BRDC at the weekend who is not going to be in the paddock, is outside the paddock bubble, but is famous enough to come and do a session. I have to say I'm delighted the way it's worked out, because in the case of my group, we have we've got John Watson coming to join
me. Oh, fabulous.
So it's so we'll need subtitles for the two of us when we get together with our Northern Ireland accents. Someone said to me the other benefit of having John is that we won't need a microphone, because he has a rather booming voice, which is terrific. But I'm just delighted, because my first ever Formula One race was British Grand Prix at Silverstone in 1981, and this is the 40th anniversary of John taking a very famous victory. And I can't wait to chat to him about it, because it was a big day for me. Whether the other guests will enjoy hearing about Silverstone 81 or not, but anyway, John will no doubt be very entertaining. And the great thing about John is he doesn't hold back on his opinions, which is actually what you want. You're never going to get a vanilla response from someone like John, and more power to him.
Do you know, I was on a tram in Melbourne two or three years back, going to the pre-season Red Bull press conference, and I heard a loud and, as you say, booming familiar voice seemingly chatting up a woman on the tram and talking about wineries and things like that. And I thought, is that John Watson? Turned around, yes, it was John Watson. yes, well, I've got a bit of wine, yes. Anyhow, we are terribly digressing. Stuart Pringle also says how valuable it is for there to be three home heroes at the Grand Prix, for the crowd to cheer for, even though, as we said, so much pent-up demand coupled up with people unable to go on holiday that basically Sunday's a sellout and Saturday probably will be as well. This month, we've looked at all three of those British drivers. Lewis Hamilton won last year's British Grand Prix on three wheels. This year, the wheels seem to have come off already.
Not in Bottas's case.
they never got put on, let alone refusing to come off. Ben's taken a look at how a driver's mindset shapes their ability to become a multiple world champion. And you spoke exclusively to Paddy Lowe, former technical director of McLaren and Mercedes, among others, Ben.
Yes. Thanks to Paddy for taking part in this story. When I spoke to him, he said he gets quite a number of requests to talk about Lewis because of his particular position in Lewis's career trajectory, spanning those two teams and most of it. And he doesn't say yes to all of them. I imagine he's getting quite tired of talking about his time.
Yeah, can't we talk about me for once?
So I'm very grateful that he took the time to go through the motions with me. He painted this quite interesting picture, basically, of a driver who classically had all the stunning natural ability that we've seen for many years, has been on display often, but didn't really quite have the work ethic that you needed to really maximise that. And for most of the McLaren years and even his early Mercedes career, Lewis kind of got away with that. You know, he had achieved phenomenal success, obviously champion in his second year, race wins in every season, I think, he's been in Formula One. And obviously a lot of this is well documented, really the crux was for Paddy was that 2016 season, the last one alongside Nico Rosberg. I mean, we saw how Lewis kind of fell apart a little bit in that year, you know, became quite stroppy, started speaking in riddles about the team and some kind of conspiracy to rob him of the world championship because he was having so many engine failures and he couldn't understand why it was always him. And this seemed a bit of a throwback to those McLaren years just after Lewis achieved his world championship, where, you know, he seemed to go off the rails a little bit, have a few too many collisions, make a few ill-judged comments in the media about things that were happening to him. You know, everyone remembers the Ali G incident in Monaco when he clattered past Maldonado and then made a kind of poor joke about why the stewards were picking on him. And he seemed to have left that behind, and 2016 seemed to kind of bring that back out of him, because Paddy was saying, you know, drivers like Lewis, and it's true for all of the top guys, they have incredible self-belief and they expect to win. And when they don't consistently, they struggle to process why that might be. And really, that season was just an unfortunate one for Lewis. You know, he had the way the engine rules were, you know, you can have one problem and it can lead to another problem and can lead to another problem. And sometimes you're just chasing your tail with fixes. But Lewis couldn't really process that. And he let that championship get away from him. And Paddy was saying that's really the season that he realised that he needed to come in and maximise every single weekend, 100%, leave no stone unturned, always get the best result, because you never know what's going to happen. You can't predict how you're going to do in the next race, even if you've got the dominant car and you're the dominant driver and you should by rights be winning. He said Lewis kind of almost gave that championship to Nico. By the time he got on the case, it was too late and the gap was too big. And of course, he still was unlucky in the sense that if that Malaysia engine failure hadn't happened, he would have won the championship. But since 2016, and this is kind of the point at which, you know, obviously Paddy's involvement in Lewis's career dissipates, he says you see a different Lewis Hamilton, the one we've seen from 2017 to now, the, you know, seven times world champion and most successful driver ever. He's kicked on to that next gear because of that experience of being humbled a little bit in 2016. And now, yes, okay, he has his extracurricular activities that, you know, some elements of the media are fond of disparaging, but when he's at the track and it's time to do the job now, he's fully focused all the time on how do I maximise each session, how do I maximise the race result. If things don't go right, how do we fix it, how do we improve? He's not distracted. And I think it's interesting to deal with this subject in the context of this season, because I think he's now under pressure probably like no time since 2016. I know he had those fairly tight fights with Ferrari in 2017 and 18, but Ferrari weren't really all there. You know, they made a lot of mistakes. Sebastian Vettel made a lot of mistakes. I think Lewis had a bit of an easier time than he's having now, where you've got Red Bull, Honda and Max Verstappen absolutely with the bit between their teeth, full focus, desperate to deny him that eighth championship and win their first for many years. So it'll be interesting to see how Lewis deals with this growing threat through the season, especially when Mercedes aren't firing on all cylinders and, you know, they've got their particular development strategy with the car that he might not agree with. You know, he's heading into the realms of a sort of Robert Kubica 2008 style season where, you know, we might give up this year because we're focusing on next year, but yeah, what about this year? We need to win while we can. So I think Lewis will need all of this champion's mental strength and aura that he's built up through experience, and we'll see if he can keep a lid on it as this championship gets away from him. A big weekend at Silverstone, actually, because Mercedes are going to bring an upgrade and they desperately need to, I think, to have a chance of arresting Red Bull's momentum. So if Lewis can get a win in front of the home fans, I think that will go a long way to steadying the ship and setting up the second half of the season. But if Max runs away with it again, I think it could be big trouble, and then we'll see how Lewis copes with that.
Yeah, really interesting feature. And as you say, Paddy, because he's freed from
the shackles.
His duties, the shackles are off. You know, he works for himself now, and he's not, you know, technical director somewhere else where he has to be careful about what he says. So, but Paddy's very interesting on this point. And as you say, he feels that the Rosberg championship year changed Lewis, and he learned how to dig deeper. And I know we're going on to talk about the Lando Norris feature a little bit later on, but again, when you read about young drivers and how they've got the talent to drive a racing car quickly, but they've got to develop all the other aspects around them, and some of them eventually do get to the point of realizing just how much hard work you need to put in on top of your talent. So I've always been a great believer that the world is full of talented drivers and the world is full of hardworking drivers, but world champions are hardworking, talented drivers. They put both together and they keep digging. And they keep digging deeply to find out every facet that can affect performance. And I think, as I may have mentioned in the podcast previously, I did an event with Lewis before the start of the pandemic. It was in Singapore in February 2019. And we had a conversation about what he's learned since he became a Formula One driver, how he's changed. And he volunteered the fact that he didn't realise at the beginning of his career, how much impact he could have on the atmosphere and the mood in the team. And that if he was feeling down and moody and difficult, and he came into the garage and he wasn't talking to people or he wasn't smiling, it would bring the mood down. And then the flip side was if he came bouncing into the garage saying, right, let's go for it, boys, this weekend, and girls, you know, we're going to win. You know, it's, he said, the team looked to me and he said, but I have a leadership role. But Lewis's point was you learn how to lead inside the team, how to build spirit, how to overcome difficulties. And I've been finding it interesting with Max winning and, you know, Red Bull winning the last four races. I mean, with Max taking a pretty solid lead in the World Championship, a small percentage of Lewis's fans seem to be really struggling with the notion that someone else can be winning. And you know, if you say anything about how great it is to see how, you know, Red Bull are doing and Max, you know, some of Lewis's fan base kind of say, well, you've always hated Lewis Hamilton and all of that. And the reason I mention that, if you understand Formula One and you're a really passionate Lewis Hamilton fan, you will actually understand he is loving the challenge at the minute. I mean, he may not be loving losing, and he certainly doesn't like losing, but it's really interesting how many media interviews at the moment he actually talks about the fact that he's relishing this battle. You know, that he's got a mountain to climb to beat Max Verstappen, and he knows Mercedes have got to find a way to improve the car. And as you say, Ben, he's not interested in a transitional year. He wants to win the World Championship this year. He wants to find out how can we, you know, yes, of course we've got 22 coming along, but hey guys, you know, Red Bull, I've got a faster car this year, so we've got to somehow get around that. So I think he's, you know, he's matured enormously, and well, what, you know, he is 36, so why wouldn't he have, you know, he's got a vast amount of time behind him. He's learned what's required of him, and it will be really interesting to see how both he and Mercedes over the balance of this season respond to what is uncharted territory, where they've been beaten on pace, they've sometimes been beaten on strategy, and it kind of, at no stage would you ever say Mercedes have been complacent, but it would appear to be the fact that the regulation, the aero change for this year, they somehow perhaps felt was inconsequential. And that's possibly because it may have been undoubtedly the fact that Mercedes didn't fully understand the implications of the aero change, not on them, but on Red Bull. So they knew what the change would be for them, but they didn't fully understand how the high rake, Newey design philosophy would not be as impacted as it has been. So there's been an interesting, it's been a really interesting few months actually, just to witness, and it really shows again, doesn't it, how finely balanced the margins are within the sport at the top end. You know, we think Mercedes have been totally dominant for years. They've been dominant just by small percentage points across a number of areas, and it doesn't require much of a change. And suddenly they're being beaten.
Funny you should mention that, because Andrew Benson has composed a marvellous feature on that very subject.
Yes, okay. I was going to say next month we're going to dig a little bit deeper into the story of this season so far, and that war between Red Bull and Mercedes, and exactly why Mercedes has taken the approach it has to this year, and why Red Bull's almost opposite approach of throwing the kitchen sink actually makes sense for them in terms of where they are on their journey, if you like. So yeah, it's and it deals with that exact point you make, Mark, about how fine the margins are, and it doesn't take much to turn things around. You see it also in the most recent race with McLaren's uptick in performance and how Norris was able to apply pressure to Hamilton and Bottas, which you would have thought ridiculous at the start of this year based on where McLaren were, but you know, they've been pushing hard with their car, making progress with it, probably thinking a little bit more about this year than next year. Mercedes are kind of at the end of a development slope with their current concept of car. So it's harder for them to find more performance, as well as having this idea that maybe they need to balance resources a bit differently. And of course, then you throw in the budget cap and everyone having different ways of having to deal with the resource restrictions and wind tunnel time and extra restrictions and performance balancing that's been done in the regulations this year regarding that as well. You know, the cards are stacked against Mercedes in a way they haven't been for probably many years. So, yeah, very interesting. And the point of the feature, I guess, is to help people understand why Lewis is so calm in the face of this onslaught, because that's the thing you notice. You know, he's been having his arse handed to him the last few races by Max, but you don't see him throwing the toys. You don't see him getting particularly irate. He stays calm. He tries to stay logical. And Lewis wasn't always like that. And you see, actually, Max isn't really like that. It's going well at the moment, but in the periods where it hasn't been going so well, he's been very prone to frustration and outbursts against external forces, sometimes against his own team. Lewis has been there and done that. He doesn't do it anymore. And that's a big part of his evolution as a champion.
Even if he does get stroppy in the moment, he dials it back in very quickly, doesn't he? For instance, I think after Monaco, there was a little bit of snippiness about strategy, but then it's a little bit like when he put his back left wheel in the guttering in Austria the other week. He corrects the slide and gets back on track very, very, very quickly. I suppose we should move on to speak about the other British drivers as well, because we've spoken to and about them in this issue. And also in terms of mindset, a few months ago we spoke to George Russell and he talked about the amount of work that goes into being an effective driver, and he was actually looking at ways of making his time, spending his time more efficiently. He thought it's not about the hours you put in, it's how effectively you use them. And it was very interesting to speak to Lando for this feature we've run about his sort of journey towards being a complete Formula One driver, and he was saying how he's unlocked changes and improvements in his own performance just by prioritizing better. Like he said, he would go into meetings and he'd have 10 million ideas, and it's like, oh, we do this, we do that, and he'd be chatting and talking, and not a lot was getting done productively because he wasn't being focused. And now he's much better at prioritizing and saying, okay, well, this needs doing, but let's park that with the guys and gals in the factory. That's something they can look at for now. This other thing is something we need to focus on now. And it's basically all about setting priorities so you tackle one job at a time rather than basically firing everything at the wall to see what sticks. And he thinks that has really, really helped him. And I suppose the other thing for me as an observer, he's obviously, you know, he's come on leaps and bounds in qualifying, but people talk about him as being not a great qualifier, and I find this baffling. When it's almost become a captive epithet that people say, oh, Lando, he's not been a great qualifier traditionally, whereas actually against Carlos Sainz he was more or less even. And I think what we're seeing this year, he's actually started to outperform the car, and he said without sort of stroking his own ego, he did say that, you know, the Monaco qualifying performance especially was extraordinary because nobody thought that pace was in the car, and he managed to find something that wasn't there, which, I don't know, to my mind, that's the mark of a truly great driver, when you start to actually find stuff that isn't necessarily there.
I think it's a really interesting the point you make, because there is a while it is wonderful to see a Lewis Hamilton come into Formula One and, you know, jump in a quick car and nearly win the world championship in his first attempt and, you know, arrive with a bang and be right there, it's somehow it's even more satisfying, I find, and maybe more human, to see someone like Lando come in with a bag of talent and then begin this trajectory of improvement. And you get to witness. Now, admittedly, I think the trajectory of Lando Norris's improvement has paralleled the improvements the team has been making. So it's been 3 years of McLaren improving their performance as well as Lando improving his performance. So, but it's allowed him time to build his experience. And as McLaren has unlocked more and more performance in their car, Lando has unlocked more and more performance in himself. So he's growing with the team. And I think this is possibly one of the reasons why Daniel Ricciardo is struggling, because essentially Lando's much more plugged into McLaren and has been working with him for a number of years and has joined him at a time when they were effectively pressing the reset button and rebuilding. So they've been rebuilding while he's been building his career. So the Lando McLaren relationship is particularly strong and very, very hand in glove. And then to see him unlock, you know, you mentioned Monaco qualifying. I mean, look at Austria qualifying. He very nearly took that pole position. And I think, I mean, we knew that Max made up the time in the final sector. I don't know if either of you have seen, there's a Twitter feed that shows what they call a ghost lap, where they superimpose Lando's car with Max's car for the whole lap. Now, that is worth watching, because what's really clear is that over sector 1 and 2, Lando was ahead. He was actually up on Max the whole way around that lap until, it's actually really until you get to the last two corners, when suddenly Max makes a kind of half a car and then a full car length advantage through that, just that last part. It's actually that last part of the last sector. And really interesting to watch, because it brings home to you the fact that Lando was absolutely right on it there. And his growth as a driver is, again, going back to what we were talking about with Lewis, you know, Lando's beginning to understand his leadership role in the team. I mean, to be blunt, he's been destroying his teammate this year, and he is he's building in his confidence, and you can see a change in his demeanor. I mean, he's still a fun-loving guy, and he's still a very young guy, but all the, as you mentioned in the feature, the japes that he used to get involved in at the beginning of his career have kind of diminished. You know, it's not that he wasn't taking it seriously, but he now understands the degree of focus that he needs to bring to the job. And that prioritization story is really interesting, because, again, he's, as a young driver, you see it all the time in junior formula, young drivers come in and say, you know, the car's a mess, you know, and you think, well, that's not really very helpful. So let's talk about, you know, if you had to fix one thing, what would it be? And they go, well, actually, we need to fix the understeer, or, you know, it's not quick enough in a straight line, or whatever happens to be. So the reality is that ability to prioritize, to focus, which actually does mean the work ethic has to change, it has to improve, that level of analytical feedback and input that the driver can bring has to go up to another level. And Lando's clearly learning how to do that. And we all know you actually show it beautifully with the graphics on this feature. You know, he's kind of loading. I think you've got him at 93%. You know, there's still
the progress bar. Yeah.
Progress bar. Yeah. I mean, there is so much more to come. And where is it going to end? And I think Lewis, who's towards the end of his career, having just re-signed for 2 more years, you've got Lando and you've got George, and what a bright future for British fans, for English fans of Formula One, because it's we've got an embarrassment of riches with these guys.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been so impressed with Lando this year. I have to say, I wasn't totally convinced before this season. I think I said on a previous podcast, I had George Russell slightly ahead of Lando, and mainly I think because of this self-belief element. I mean, not to get too much into the Russell element too soon, but what strikes you about him is how he's at a very early stage learned those lessons, probably from Lewis, who he's said before he studied a lot while he was, you know, Mercedes reserve and test driver and what have you, about how you behave inside the team. So Mark, you made that point about Lewis understanding that his mood and his demeanor affects everybody around him, so he's conscious of how he behaves during an event. And George seemed to pick that up very quickly, that he needed to be a leader, an unofficial leader in the team, in terms of how he behaves, how he gets the most out of the people around him, and that even to the point where he would think about modifying his language so that when he was debriefing he would say things in a certain way so as not to get people's backs up. Make your point so that it's productive. And he's cottoned onto this very early. And that's partly, I think, his personality. He has this, as it says in the feature, this aura about him where he says things and people listen. That's what Dave Robson of Williams says. So I think George naturally had this character that exuded confidence, self-belief, knew how to manage situations, manage people, and gain progress from that. And you can see that at Williams too. You know, he's finding things in the car that they're not expecting. You know, that Q3 performance in Austria, for example, incredible. He's been doing that consistently, and that's a result of all that work he's been putting in, and that work evolving from his character and understanding how to behave. And I didn't think Lando quite had that. And I think the feature addresses, actually, when he started in Formula One, he did have a crisis of confidence and he wasn't sure of himself. And, you know, that's fine. That's not to be critical of him, but we didn't perhaps at the time understand that he was going through that. So I just saw this driver that was perhaps maybe not quite there in the mentality. And I felt that that would hold him back and that he, you know, he might not make the progress he has. But as Mark says, he's grown over time with each season. As the team's improved and helped him, Lando's found more confidence in himself. And now I think you see a driver that has the same sort of self-belief and confidence that George Russell has. They're not the same personality. But you see Lando has the trust of the people around him. He knows how to motivate them in his own way. He has this relationship with Zak Brown that's quite special, and it seems that Lando to Zak is almost what Lewis was to Ron Dennis, and that seems to work quite well. And Lando, again, finding things now in the car that perhaps the team don't expect. I mean, Daniel Ricciardo, after that qualifying session, said he was lost for words when he congratulated Lando, but he actually said, I could not do that lap time in the car. So that just tells you, you know, we know how good Daniel Ricciardo is. So a massive test for him now, because he's up against a driver who's performing at a very, very high level. Arguably, I would say, Lando's been maybe the best driver on the grid this year in terms of relative performance. Okay, yeah, Max is having a stunning season, but Max has made one or two errors, particularly in the early part of the year, that have been quite costly, whether it's a pole position or a race result. Lando isn't making the same number of mistakes, I don't think.
I dare you to write that on Twitter.
But it's close, you know. He's Twitter, yeah, the court of public opinion. But he's definitely up there, I think. You know, he's taken a big step this year. And yeah, kudos to him, because I wasn't sure, absolutely convinced that he had it in him, but he's proved me wrong this year. I think he's been absolutely stunning, so well done to him.
And we can move on to George Russell, because, you know, as we, when we commissioned Luke Smith to write this feature about George and his relationship with the Williams team and how he's actually becoming a prime mover in bringing that team back into the midfield and further towards the front of the grid, we did say, feel free to heap ordure on the absurd Mr. Saturday tag, because he's so much more than a bloke who just gets in the car and arguably outperforms it or finds something there and advances it up the grid on a Saturday. You know, he's a complete driver who is galvanizing the team. And, you know, as you alighted upon there, Dave Robson says when he talks, people listen, and he's learned how to be an influential person.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting that the feature takes down this Mr. Saturday tag sort of lazy caricature, if you like, because it, funnily enough, it's the Saturday performances and particularly the recent ones that are the evidence of the work that he's putting in behind the scenes. The fact that he's been able to get that Williams into a situation where it can go through Q2 on the right tyre for strategy, not just by throwing everything you've got at it in terms of one lap pace, is a result of all that hard work he's been putting in, developing with the team, understanding how they work, helping them work better, allowing his preferences and desires to permeate and become realised on the car. And you can see the gap between him and his teammate. Okay, you know, Nicholas Latifi's at a different stage of his career to someone like Daniel Ricciardo, so the comparison's not like for like. But nevertheless, Russell's performance in, let's say, lower quality machinery compared to people like Lewis and Lando is still worthy of great praise. Hopefully this feature explains a little bit of the background as to how George has been able to get into that position, because it's not magic. Obviously, he's a very quick driver, but as Mark was saying earlier on the podcast, there are many, 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 many talented drivers in the world who could do well in the right car, but it's finding that extra bit is a very, very difficult, torturous process, and that's what separates the great from the good. And I think George and Lando are on that trajectory now, aren't they? There's a long way to go in their careers, obviously, but they are looking like great drivers, which is great for the British fans going to Silverstone.
Yeah, George is a very impressive guy. And I think this is a great feature because it really, it does take the reader below the surface of his performances in the Williams into some of the detail about, I mean, I love Dave Robson's comments about George and his contribution to the team. The fact that they recognise the degree to which he helps lift the whole team. The recognition at the beginning of a season, of any season when you have an uncompetitive car, that moment when everyone in the garage realises the car is not quick enough. You know,
and the collective sigh,
and you know, you've been eating your Christmas turkey, thinking, "Oh, next year we're really going to nail it," and then here you are, 10 weeks later or 8 weeks later, standing in Barcelona at a test, thinking, "Wow, this is going to be a write off of a season." You know, we're way off the pace. So, you know, for George to join Williams at a time when they've been going through a profound slump in the team's history. And again, to help them to claw their way out of that. And my goodness, I would imagine, and I think you've got a nice quote there from Jos Capito. I mean, Jos Capito and François Xavier FX de Maison, the technical director, I mean, they would just love to keep that guy. Because if you were to think about the jigsaw puzzle that Williams have to put together to return to the forefront of Formula One, George is a big piece of that puzzle who they've already got. And they really don't want to lose him. And take 30 seconds to just speculate. You know, if you zoom out and you think about the fact that in Austria, while everyone was busy, you know, talking about Max's domination and all the other things that were happening on track, off track, you have Porsche and Audi turning up to the power unit meeting about the 2025 regulations. And you've got Porsche and Audi sitting down with Mercedes and with Renault and with Ferrari talking about the future of Formula One engine regulations. You can imagine Jos Capito will have been all over that, because with both he and FX de Maison both being ex-Volkswagen Group people, you can almost build a picture, can't you, of how, you know, Jos will be thinking, well, if I can get... You know, even if Porsche or Audi decided to do their own team and pay the $200 million bond that you'd have to pay to get in, even if we could just become like their primary second team, their primary customer team, the opportunity for George to stay at Williams and to be part of what could become a Porsche program in Formula One, that's the kind of thing that Jos would be trying to sell to George. But of course, for George, having had this tantalizing opportunity to drive a Mercedes in F1 in Bahrain, stick it on the front row of the grid and, I mean, nearly win the race. I mean, George knows that George knew that if he jumps into a Mercedes, you know, he's going to win races in the World Championship. It'd be interesting to
not now. That's the
why I shifted gear on my statement, because actually he might now be looking and thinking, wow, you know, Mercedes have been toppled.
Have they peaked? That's an interesting question, isn't it?
And
have they charlesed?
So, you know, there's all of that. But anyway, through it all, there's no getting away from the fact that George Russell's a formidable talent and Williams don't want to lose him. And one suspects that Mercedes are probably, if they haven't already, looking to get his signature on a contract.
Yeah. Tantalising stuff in the future. Now, we're going to have to sign off in a bit, because I know, Mark, you've got a conference call and we've been slightly delayed by IT problems that the listeners don't need to worry about in the background there. So we're sort of pressed for time today. We had some very sad news last night, which was that Carlos Reutemann has passed away after a long illness at the age of 79, and I suppose, you know, obviously, you know, people get older and they do leave us, and it's just a shame that he's been a kind of a quiet part of Formula One history for many years, because he's had a very productive second career in public service. But during the 1970s, he was to my mind, such an important part of that late 70s scene, one of the personalities, one of the characters when Formula One was achieving much more globally widespread TV coverage. I think people talk about 1976 and James Hunt and Niki Lauda as being kind of a catalyst for really bringing Formula One into the consciousness of the global public, that great rivalry. But Carlos Reutemann was just one of those characters who, you know, on his day, when the car was to his liking, he could be absolutely incendiary in qualifying in a race, couldn't he?
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, what just even listening to what you're saying about his positioning, this sort of the quiet presence that he has in the history of Formula One. People like Gordon Murray and, you know, the famous Brabham designer and Gary Anderson, who worked with him at Brabham, who later went on to achieve fame as a designer of the Jordan 191. People like Gordon and Gary, they talk about the fact that he was a quiet man, that Carlos Reutemann was not a loud presence in the paddock. He just quietly got on with the job. He finished in the top three in the Drivers World Championship on four occasions. He was third three times and second once. And that second place in the World Championship, oddly enough, is why he's regarded as a flawed character, because he went into the final race of the 1981 season leading the championship, and he qualified on pole. And he just, I think he needed to beat, it was Nelson Piquet he needed to beat, and I forget what the points margin were, but he went from pole to finishing eighth in the race, had this bizarre race, which Patrick Head, the Williams technical director, said, we will never understand what happened, because the car was fine. He said he had a gearbox problem, but we never found any problem with the car. So last, you know, Vegas in 81 cast a shadow over Reutemann's motivations, but I don't think he was ever an unmotivated person within his Formula One career. It certainly seemed, he seemed to have some self-doubt, which pervaded throughout his career. And people talk about the fact that he, although he had these film star looks and had this great natural talent as a racing driver, there seemed to be conflict within him and some self-doubt. But it's interesting when you look at some of the detail. His very first Formula One race, Argentina 72, Brabham, he stuck the car in pole position. That's a pretty awesome achievement. He may have known the track like the back of his hand, but nevertheless, to step into Formula One, stick it on pole was pretty impressive. Interesting also that he drove for four teams, all of whom were giants of their times. You know, drove for Brabham, drove for Ferrari, had a very good relationship with Gilles Villeneuve. The story of how he got dropped by Ferrari is just so typical of Enzo Ferrari. So he was waiting to re-sign his contract, and Jody Scheckter jumped into a hire car beside Carlos and said to him, by the way, I think you should know I've just been signed as number one driver for your team. That's how Carlos found out that he wasn't re-signed by Ferrari. And he then beat a path to Colin Chapman's door to drive for Lotus. And then, of course, emerged from that after discovering the 1979 car wasn't that good. He then decided to jump across to Williams, which is where he finished his career. An extraordinarily good-looking guy. I mean, just some of the photographs of him from the 70s, it could be some made-up television commercial. He's got such an on-screen presence. And then, of course, had this very successful career in politics afterwards. But, yeah, a sad loss. And I think definitely one of those iconic 1970s, early 80s characters within Formula One, I suspect the like of which we'll never quite see again.
I love the fact that he... And respect the fact that he had his Formula One career and then kind of left it, you know, didn't dine off it for the remainder of his life, you know, got on with other things.
You get could drivers you possibly be speaking about?
I don't. I mean, you know, there's each to their own, but you have to respect that he had other callings. I mean, there are some drivers, I don't know if Reutemann was one of these, who succeed in spite of themselves. Because not everybody loves it. You know, we have this idea that, you know, because we're all massive enthusiasts, and many of the people who do it and succeed are also massive enthusiasts and fans, and that's how they start off, and then they remain fans afterwards, and they never want to leave the world of Formula One or motor racing more widely. But some have the ability but don't really have the love for it you know, they see through it maybe, or they, you know, they find that it's what's involved, the sacrifices, or, you know, the way the whole world works, or the safety, perhaps in those days particularly, you know, that it troubles them, and they do well because they just have this ability to drive cars quickly. But at the same time, they almost wish they had a, you know, God-given gift, if you like, to do something else with their lives. I don't know if Reutemann had that in him. You know, maybe that's where the self-doubt came from. Sometimes it does happen. But I also respect the fact that when the Argentinian Grand Prix Buenos Aires came onto the calendar, he did a demo run. Stuart, you and I were talking about this. I think it was the 94 Ferrari, I think he did the run in. And he was like extraordinarily quick.
Yeah, he set a time good enough for ninth on the grid or something.
Absolutely remarkable to just go, okay, yeah, I'll do it. If it's good for the country, I'll do it. And then bang. Hi, guys. Still got it.
Yeah, so yeah, farewell to a legend. Thank you for everything, Carlos Reutemann. And thank you to my guests, because I'm afraid it's time to let you go onto your next call, Mark. Thank you very much for joining us and sharing your insights and wits and wisdom. And we might just get to see one another if you want to come around and say hello to the campers. And
yeah, I shall try and do
the hi-hi business.
See you at Silverstone.
And Ben, we won't see you at Silverstone, but I'll see you on another Zoom call. One thing you do need to do is straighten your pictures behind you, because one's on the wonk and it's been troubling me throughout this entire recording.
Yes, I can see, yes.
Just a quick bit of OCD at the end.
Maybe I'll leave it just to irritate you a bit further.